Hey everyone, my name is Jonathan Brooke, and this is Eyes Only. A silent phone call rings into a clandestine office. A U.S. official answers. The call is coming out of Russia. No one speaks. 10 seconds pass, then the line disconnects. A double agent has just made contact with the Central Intelligence Agency. On the other end of the line, calling from a public payphone, is Soviet military intelligence officer Oleg Pinkovsky. The number he is calling from and the length of the call is a coded message. The line is not secure. Listening ears are everywhere. Pinkovsky has directed them to a predetermined location, a telephone pole marked with a symbol written in chalk. On this day, the symbol is an X. The simple chalk mark means that the dead drop site at a predetermined Moscow apartment has been loaded. This is what the high-stakes, high-reward process of stealing state secrets looks like. Pinkovsky's work over a year and a half period produced a remarkable amount of material for the Central Intelligence Agency. Through dead drops as well as in-person meetings with agents, he supplied over 100 cassettes of exposed Minox film, each one containing around 50 exposures of frames, those frames containing Russian classified documents. Both MI6 and the CIA would set up dedicated teams to dissect and evaluate the information as it came in. All in all, these teams put together 10,000 pages of intelligence reports based off of just one source. The intelligence was so elaborate and far-reaching, a system was put in place to make it appear that it was coming from multiple people, a measure taken to protect Pinkovsky. Material that was scientific and quantifiable went under codename Ironbark. The material that was created due to personal observations went under codename Chickadee. What he has for them today is unclear. What is known is that the dead drop location is loaded and ready for pickup. Richard Jacobson walks the streets of Moscow, his trench coat wrapped tightly around him, doing its best to shelter him from the fall weather. He is new to this city. It's a new assignment for him. He heads to an apartment building, its street number 56 Pushkinskaya. Where he is heading could be as simple as picking up a new cassette. Or he could be intercepting a coded message, one whose details could notify them that World War III is beginning. It is November 2nd, 1962. 4 days earlier, the Cuban Missile Crisis had just come to an end. The tension and fear of nuclear war is heavy in the air. The dead drop Jacobson is picking up is codenamed Distant. It is designed for Pinkovsky to not only share information, but for him to also provide an early warning for nuclear war. Pinkovsky has not been heard from in months. The timing of his resurface is troubling. Jacobson enters the apartment complex. He walks through the hallway. Beneath the stairs, a radiator sits along the wall. Jacobson reaches behind it and grabs a length of wire. At the end of the wire is a matchbox. He detaches the matchbox and slips it into the pocket of his coat. In the shadows, someone snaps a photograph. An image immortalized in time. An incriminating picture of a spy stealing secrets. Seconds later, a group of KGB agents appear out of hiding and jump him. In the scuffle, Jacobson drops the matchbox through a slit in his coat and onto the floor, removing it from his person. He is subdued by the KGB, thrown into a waiting car, and whisked away. He has been burned. He is now a guest of the KGB, a spy operating for a hostile foreign government. At Langley, on the ground floor of the building, inside the communications center, a secure cable is received. It arrives through a line used by personnel stationed in Moscow. What prints out is a heavily encrypted transmission. A neat array of seemingly random numbers and letters on a sheet of standard letter-sized paper. It is placed inside a heavy manila envelope and sealed with tape. Unlike most other communications, Soviet station cables are only hand-delivered to their destinations within the building. A young Soviet Russia division officer receives the envelope and walks it to his superior's office. At his desk, the superior officer removes the letter and by hand, with painstaking care, begins deciphering the message. Slowly, its contents are revealed. A message that within 24 hours would make its way up the chain of command, all the way into President John F. Kennedy's office. The question on everyone's mind, what went wrong? Where is Penkovsky? And how did the Russians find out? The night air is cold. He can no longer feel his hands. Swinging his body forward, he wraps his legs around the wire. The high-tension wire stretching across what has ominously become known as the Death Strip. Horst Klein is risking his life to escape East Germany. 60 feet below him, armed guards patrol, unaware that he's hanging above them. Klein is not the first to make the treacherous journey over, under, or directly through the Berlin Wall. He will not be the last to make the attempt either. Thousands have succeeded, yet roughly 600 have died, shot and killed for attempting to leave the Soviet Union. Klein is an anti-communist. That political path has put him at odds with the government he now lives under. Banned from practicing the circus art he loves, he has chosen to use his talents to escape. He is a trapeze artist. For him, life without the circus is, as he describes, worse than death. He would rather die. His body shakes. His arms are weak. Slowly, he inches along the wire, trying not to make a sound. He cannot hold on anymore. He slips. His hands fail him. He falls. Klein slams into the ground below. The bones in both of his arms shatter from the impact. He lies there, unsure of what his future will look like. On that cold winter night, he finds himself a refugee of Western Germany. His arms have failed him at the exact right spot for him to fall over the western side of the Berlin Wall. He has made it. The stretch of land he has just crossed is one of the most recognizable emblems of the Cold War. A city split in two. For decades, Berlin would be considered the espionage capital of the world. A city full of spies. A visible representation of the divide between political ideologies, economic concepts, and governmental systems. The stretch of land, well before the Berlin Wall went up, would be the location of an elaborate and remarkable feat of espionage. A joint operation run by both MI6 and the CIA. The purpose? To steal secrets. In the fall of 1954, an East German farmer is working in his field. He is planting an orchard, his dream plot of land. Soon he will bring his family there to live. He is working to build a legacy for his family. As he works, he hears a strange sound. He cannot place where it's coming from. It baffles him. It sounds like a water pump that's running. It doesn't make any sense. He's in the middle of nowhere. Shaking it off, he keeps working. Below his feet, a machine pumps the water out of a tunnel. An enormous operation is underway less than 30 feet beneath him. The excavation of a secret tunnel being built by the US and the British. They are digging their way to a specific location. Their destination, the Soviet telephone lines connecting to East Berlin. The plan? to tap into them. On the other side of the border, a plot of farmland had been purchased. A new radar station had been built on it. It is a fully operational radar station, one that would actually prove very useful. Yet its entire existence is a cover. Beneath it, in the basement, is the entrance of a tunnel. A tunnel that reaches 1,480 feet through some of the most heavily guarded terrain on Earth. Tunneling underneath international boundary lines, guard posts, highways, and directly under Soviet soldiers' feet. The workers move 3,000 tons of dirt and debris covertly without detection. Entire rooms are hollowed out, the walls supported by steel and reinforced with concrete. The entire structure rigged with explosives to be destroyed upon detection. All through the process, the workers having to pause to avoid detection as people and machinery move above them. In May of 1955, the first successful wiretap is completed. In order for their tap to not be detected, only the weakest signal possible could be drawn. Sending that signal a quarter of a mile distance required amplifying the signal at the source, or else it would be lost. A room full of amplifying equipment is set up, highly sensitive equipment that requires a super sterile environment. It required immaculate conditions without exposure to moisture. An enormous effort went into maintaining the room where it was set up. Workers described it as being so sterile you could conduct surgery inside of it. Feats like this were ongoing to keep their operation a secret. During the winter, the issue of heat produced by the machines escaping and melting the snow above became a problem. A chilled water system was developed. That, coupled with air-conditioned machines running constantly, kept the tunnel cool enough so it wouldn't melt the snow above. The wiretap, an operation codenamed Operation Gold, lasted for 11 months. 77,000 hours of Russian and German phone calls were recorded. Teleprint signals, many of them multiplexed, were also captured. A team of 317 Russian immigrants and German linguists worked out of London and translated the intelligence as it came in. On April 21st, 1956, East German and Russian soldiers broke through into the tunnel, taking the British and Americans working there by such a level of surprise, many were caught with their coffee cups still in their hands. MI6 and the CIA caught red-handed in one of the most elaborate wiretapping operations we know of. It was a national embarrassment. Except that's not what happened. A web of lies had been weaved, one that would take years to untangle. The tunnel was evacuated well before the Soviets burst into it. This is just the beginning of what turned into a very strange, imperfect example of what covert espionage looks like when it becomes public. On April 20th, during an exceptionally wet spring, Berlin telephone lines began to experience shorts. Soviet repair crews, while working on one of the problems, discovered the wiretap. It was meant to look like a shocking discovery. Yet Russian leadership had orchestrated the discovery. It would turn into a large press production. The Russians and East Germans, shocked and outraged, calling the tap a breach of the norms of international law. It developed into an international press sensation for weeks. The US and Britain were surprised by the reaction. They expected the Soviets to be embarrassed by the clear failure on their part to protect their secrets. The official statement, pre-written for CIA Director Alan Dulles, was just to deny it. In short, upon discovery, the plan was to lie. It was assumed the Soviets would try to cover it up anyway. Yet the opposite happened. Photos of the tunnel, the amplification chamber, and the extent of the operation the West had pulled off were published in newspapers internationally. The Russians believed it would be embarrassing for the U.S. and Britain. They made up the story of catching people in the tunnel red-handed, ensuring to emphasize the coffee cup part to add extra embarrassment. The U.S. assumed the Soviets would keep quiet out of embarrassment. The Soviets believed telling the world would embarrass the U.S. The counter would be true. People were impressed, especially in the West. The remarkable feat that the CIA and MI6 had pulled off made them look good. The CIA was hardly 8 years old at this time. Many had feared that they would be no match for the Russian KGB. The CIA's hard work had put them in the spotlight as a competent espionage organization, one that was willing to go to extreme lengths to achieve its goals. Not everything would be as it appears, though. In the world of covert action, it rarely is. The shock of the Russian government was a facade. It was a lie. Before the first spade full of dirt had been removed from the tunnel, the Russians knew of even the most intimate details of the plan. They had known of its operation and location the entire 11 months the wiretap was running. Behind Operation Gold's betrayal lies one man. A double agent. A man who appears larger than life. The extent of his betrayal is hard to quantify. A man who lived in denial of the destruction left in his wake. His legacy is that of death and spilled blood. What made him so dangerous is that he didn't do it for money or power. He did it because he truly believed that it was the right thing to do. This story continues on my next episode. Check it out, and as always, thanks for listening.